I'm Sonia Morton Firth, and you're tuned in to the Sonia Morton Firth Show. Today, my guest is Dan Aston Gregory, entrepreneur, thought leader, activist, and podcast host. After leaving his corporate job working in the banking sector for several years, Dan is now the founder of Elevate Media, a podcast production house. He's recently launched the Pandemic Podcast, which has exploded in a very short space of time. Dan has impacted the lives of more than 100,000 entrepreneurs, and he is pioneering a movement to elevate humanity by asking the questions the rest of the world seems unwilling to answer. I've got to say, I am really honored to have you as a guest on my show today. The last time we saw each other just about a year ago in the flesh, when we were together, when I was watching you on stage at Yes Group. I've known you, Dan, for a couple of years now. When I was leader at Yes Group London, and you were leader of Yes Group Bristol. And since then, you have done amazing things. And I've been watching you, the growth of the Elevate community, which I, as I understand, has got the world record. Is it the world record longest running live summit? Is that right, Dan?
Yeah, at the time it was, we ran for 50 days straight, had over 75 speakers, reached over 100,000 people. It was the longest running live event at that time. I don't know if we've been surpassed, because obviously it's the world of online events has kicked off since that point. But we were pretty radical first movers with that project.
But look, there's loads that I want to get into. And I guess the biggest thing for us today is really to talk about what's going on in the world as we speak. And we're moving out of lockdown restrictions as we actually speak now. But things changed for you, I guess. And it all changed when you released a video. And the video entitled, which I love the title, I have been a coward, but I'm no longer willing to be silent. And Dan, this video went viral. Firstly, had you any idea of the sort of impact that this was going to cause?
No. And put it this way, you know, I spent, as I mentioned, 50 days straight doing Elevate Live, working 12-hour days to produce content 1, 3, 4, 5 times a day. Deliberately trying to go viral, deliberately trying to get the content into the hands of many people. But that one video, I'd made a couple of notes. I've been seeing the world unfold in ways that it has, and there's a lot of issues that I was uncomfortable with, and I talk about things violating my integrity gene. There was things out there I just didn't think were right. So I felt like I had to say something. That was why I titled it. I sat on the side. I forget the specific titles now. You're more close to. But it was about having the courage to finally say something and get off the sidelines. And I had no intention. I had no idea what would happen with that video. I just felt like I had to say something. You know, I saw these children going back to school in Perspex boxes, being separated from each other and queuing meters away from each other in the playground, and I just thought, these poor kids, you know, these are our future, and this is how we're treating them. Who's looking after their rights? And you know, at that point, I didn't know I was going to become a father at that point, but we were talking about it, and I thought, this is not the world that I want my future child to grow up in. So it was my point of leverage. You know, it was enough is enough, because for months I'd been watching what was unfolding in the world, and I had a lot of concerns about what I was witnessing, but it was so many contentious issues that I didn't feel comfortable speaking out about it. But that was my leverage point, and I had no idea the impact of the video. But within hours, it was just thousands and thousands of people were watching it, and by Monday morning, 10,000 people who watched it. By the end of the week, 100,000 people who watched it, and now over 500,000 people who watched it across all channels now, and it's just unbelievable. But it gave me confidence actually in that moment that I'm not alone, and that I was not alone in feeling the way that I was feeling, because, you know, I think a lot of us have been observing what's going on in the world around us, but we have felt quite isolated, not only physically, but also mentally, because, you know, what these issues we're witnessing, we kind of, can we talk about them? Is it, you know, if we dare to challenge some of the policy ideas that come from government, is that okay? But I just had to say something, and that's what happened. And I could never have predicted what followed.
I mean, it takes a brave man or woman to actually step up into what I'm going to say is your truth. And I think, you know, a lot of us may be sitting thinking that they should take a stance and want to do something about it, but actually to take action must have been quite a hard thing for you. What was going through your mind before you did this? Was this something that you'd been thinking about for months? Because it was August, right? So we'd already been in lockdown for 3 months. Was this something you'd been contemplating?
Yeah, it was for a long time, actually. So back in last February 2020, mid 2020, my wife and I went for our honeymoon in Thailand. So flying into Asia at that point, you know, we had started to see reports of the virus in China, but nothing like we've become accustomed to. So naturally, taking a flight into Asia, I thought, well, I better take a look at what's going on over there to see if it's suitable for us to go, because I was worried that, you know, if there was this serious situation that it may affect us. So I at that point began doing a lot of research. Interestingly, it started with a small scale research trying to figure out what's happening. But when I started to see how the virus was being portrayed in China versus then the actual data, even at that stage, January, February, that early on in the pandemic, there was already a giant disconnect between the media portrayal and the underlying data at that point. So I did a lot of research around the virus. I did a lot of research around the response, even down to, you know, should I be wearing a mask on the airplane? Because, you know, there are people in the airport wearing masks. I thought, my goodness, do I need to wear a mask on the plane? And I found this report from the Civil Aviation Authority, which gave me great confidence that it wouldn't be necessary to do so at that point. And from there, I'm a natural curious person. You know, I love to learn. I'm an obsessive learner, actually. And when I get my teeth into a subject, I want to know everything about it. And that began a journey of research. And in that 12 months, I read over 1,000 articles, over 100 scientific papers, countless data sets. So I'd been reading about this stuff for months before I actually said anything. But the moment you did say anything, if I typed anything onto social media, into a comment or a discussion, it was heated. It was angry. There was vitriol. Any criticism of the situation or any critique of the policy would lead to this backlash of furious comments, you know, not calm, reasonable debate. It was personal attacks. So I'd witnessed this in just comments. So I thought, gosh, I think all of that became a barrier to even being willing to speak about it. But as I said, it got to a point of being enough is enough. But I'd already by that point been thinking about it for over 6 months. You know, I'd really had. And in fact, I stopped Elevate Live because I was no longer comfortable not speaking about the virus. But it took me months to actually then get the courage to do that. You know, I felt at that point compelled to start speaking about what I was seeing. But it took several months of building up the courage to finally do it. It was that point of leverage that tipped me over the edge.
Did you have any fear over? What you did was a courageous thing, and I guess if I'm thinking about what people would think, I know you shouldn't think what people would think, but was there a fear of judgment? I mean, you know, you were being outspoken. You were speaking against society, basically what we're hearing on the mass media. We can go on and talk about that. Did you think were you in fear of disengaging with your audience, your followers, your friends, your family?
Everything. So friends, family, business connections. You know, the network in the industry that I operated in, and the network that I'd worked for a decade to build, you know, really influential individuals in the entrepreneurship space and the personal development space. There was even specific individuals I had in my mind prior to the broadcast. I was thinking, what will they think if they see this? Will they say, Dan, you know, get out of the politicians, you know, stay out of politics, stay out of the pandemic, stick to business? That was all going through my head. The fear of judgment, the fear of being criticized, the fear of, you know, being called irresponsible or selfish, or all these different things that we've seen happen that every time someone has said anything critical of the situation. I had all of that going through my mind. But it felt like my life to that point had trained me for that moment, in the sense that all of the personal development I had done to that point was about finding inner freedom, which to me is to relinquish that fear of external judgment. It doesn't mean I don't care what people think, but it means I'm no longer guided by it, and I'm no longer trapped or limited by what other people may think about my views or my actions. And I've gone through a lot of inner work to get really clear on what my core inner values are. And one of those core values is integrity. One of those core values is empathy and love and peace and gratitude. So I knew that if I communicate with those values at the core, even if people don't agree with what I have to say, I will be acting in integrity and I will be operating from a place of inner freedom. And I had to make that choice. And it's one of the most empowering choices I've ever made.
Where do you think you get your warrior spirit from?
Well, I've been seeking it for a long time. There's been a yearning inside of me since I was a kid. I was quiet. You wouldn't believe it now. My team don't believe it. But I was the quietest kid in school. I was totally. I was. I would sit on the sidelines, literally, physically. I was very shy. I had no confidence, no self-esteem. You know, you've seen me on stage. I've done talks in front of hundreds of people. I would never have been, if you'd saw me as a teenager, you would think I'm a different person. I was practically introverted. Well, I was introverted, but very shy. I lacked confidence. So I spent a long time working through my own mental inner limitations, my own limiting beliefs, my own fears and self-doubts. And I had a successful corporate career, which gave me some level of confidence in myself. But there was always this, what I call global confidence, which is, you know, I had situational confidence in my career where I could, you know, I knew that I had capabilities in certain areas, but I didn't have social confidence or global confidence. So a lot of the work that I've been doing over the last decade is building myself up and building up my self-esteem and taking on my own self-limiting thoughts and really owning who I am, you know, really owning the man that you see today and shaping and forging that person. And I think in doing that, I developed the warrior spirit, which was as long as my, and I've said it countless times, and it's been a mantra of mine ever since I left my corporate career behind. And thanks to some of the mentors I had in helping me make that decision, which was a big decision to leave corporate behind, was that as long as my mind still works and my heart still beats, I'll find a way. And that mantra has lived with me ever since. So every time, no matter what challenge I face, as long as I'm still alive, I can find a way. That's underpinned the warrior spirit. But
listening to your conviction, you know, similarly to you, I was in corporate life and I gave up that and have been looking for my true purpose ever since. And I think it's a continuing journey. The day we stop learning, the day we stop growing is the day we die. But you really have stepped into your conviction, and it sounds like your voids that you had as childhood, these voids of this feeling of being an introvert and being alone and self-isolated, you're overcoming those voids and really, Dan, you're knocking the socks off so many people, and I want to take my hat off to you. Look, we're now 1 year on, pretty much since the day we were locked down. Who could have imagined, if someone had said a year ago, this is going to happen, you're going to be locked up, you're not going to be allowed to go out, you're not going to be able to see your loved ones at Christmas or throughout the year, shops are going to be closed. I mean, it's like some sort of science fiction film.
Yes.
We're now coming out of this lockdown into the summer of freedom, as people are calling it. I'm asking myself all sorts of questions about why did we not step up and question the rules? Why do you think, Dan, that, you know, you've done so much research, you've analyzed the statistics, you've been looking at the data, why haven't the rest of the population?
Well, I think it's underestimated how many people are. I think what I've discovered is a lot of people are questioning it, but they're kind of silently questioning it. I suppose my journey to this point gave me some insights around how humans tend to interact, you know, the social dynamics, the individual psychology of the human mind, the principles of influence. All of these things gave me a really, you know, through my journey in business and through my profession and studying human performance, has given me a really interesting grounding on why people do what they do. Not only on an individual level, actually, but also on a societal level, and how societies work together and how herd mentality and crowd mentality forms. And when we look at what's happening here, we have a crisis of the unknown in the first instance. You know, this invisible pathogen that could be a risk and a threat to human life. And the way that it's portrayed early on made it, well, it's still portrayed in many ways, it's portrayed as though it's a deadly pathogen that does not discriminate and that everyone is at risk. And when you create those conditions of fear and that portrayal of risk, people lose the ability to self-contextualize the incumbent risk of the situation. And if you think about comparable situations like influenza, for instance, or the common cold, they are known quantities to us. And even though they both come with risks, and in some cohorts, and in fact, many of the same vulnerable cohorts come with significant risk. You know, I didn't know this until the pandemic started, but the common cold is one of the most common factors that lead to pneumonia in the elderly. So it's, you know, we dismiss the cold because it's, you know, we get it. The same with flu, we get it. But with the novel virus, which just means new, we didn't at that point know what impact it would have, what risk profile it would have. But by the time it reached our shores, the reality is we did have 90 days worth of data nearly. We did have nearly 3 months worth of data on the virus, and particularly at that point it was relatively clear that this is what we call an age graduated condition, in the sense that in terms of its severe risk of severe disease or mortality, you know, it's really a function of age. And you know, the average age of mortality to this day in the UK is over 82 years old, which is older.
Has that changed?
No, it hasn't changed. It's been the same since the outset. So that was my concern really from the beginning when I was looking at this. I was thinking, we're actually asking 99% of the population to protect 1% of the population rather than shielding 1% to enable the 99% to continue their livelihoods. But then we have this piece around the oversimplification of science. You know, when you make people believe that the simple act of transmitting a virus from person to person could lead to death, people can understand that. In their mind, they think, well, actually, if I spend time with any other people, I'm a risk to them. They don't think about that you're completely healthy, that you don't have a virus, that actually a healthy person with a healthy person doesn't equate an ill person. And we don't start to think about, well, actually, what are the viral dynamics? How does transmission occur? Even if someone has no symptoms, are they likely to pass on the virus? And if they do, is that person likely to get sick? And if they pass it on, will it eventually reach someone that's going to die? That becomes a complex equation, which for most people, they haven't got the capacity or time or inclination to start to unpick. It's simplified down to, you transmit the virus, you're going to kill someone. And that's almost become a marketing message. COVID-19 has become a brand. It has a logo, it has a marketing message. And as we know from other big organizations, if you watch how they market and how they create popular opinion, it's done through these marketing tactics. And it's no surprise to discover early on that the UK Scientific Advisory Group had more behavioral scientists at the beginning than virologists or immunologists. You know, virologists specialize in looking at the elements of the virus, and the immunologists look at the impact on the immune system. Yet we had more behavioral scientists who were working to create the messaging to create the human behavior. And of course, when you're in that situation, you have oversimplification of the science. You have the deference to authority, meaning that we put our trust in authority figures and we don't question them. And the psychology throughout time, and there's some interesting experiments I could talk to you about how our over-reliance on authority is dangerous. But we also have this solidarity principle, which is actually a really good thing. As a society, we want to do things for the greater good. But when that greater good is warped for the interests of the the political aspirations, then we start to lose our way with what is actually for the social good and who decides what is for the social good and what factors should be considered within that social good. Because I'm known for saying on my podcast, you can't save the entire forest by protecting just one tree. And by that, we focus so intensely on just things like COVID infections to the expense of everything else and every other factor of human society. And we've done that outside of the context of the risk, going back to the original point of how we contextualize risk. So it's a very complex equation.
It's a massively complex equation. And I guess what you've just said that there, Dan, is, you know, that we had the statistics, we had the government, we had the government relying on certain people and maybe not others. But at what point did we as a nation, as a country, or as an individual actually think for ourselves and say, does this actually seem right? I think too many people relied heavily on the news, the government, to tell them what we should be doing and listening to and believing. Yeah. Rather than actually trusting something that inherently seems wrong. I mean, inherently, keeping us locked up in our houses is not how we should live as human beings. It just isn't right.
It's not healthy.
It's not healthy. So I guess I'm back to questioning our own society and why we haven't sort of stepped up and questioned.
Well, it's exactly that. You know, it's when you, and there's actual academic papers coming out on this now. And again, it goes back to the piece around behavioral scientists. And in fact, there was a scientific model that was produced by a gentleman called Professor Niall Ferguson, a controversial figure anyway. If you look at his track record of modeling, he is the guy that you would go to for a doomsday scenario around anything. That if you were doing some business planning and you wanted to know the absolute worst case scenario for your business, get in Professor Niall Ferguson, because he'll make it look like your business has got a tragedy awaiting. It's you know, he has a history of that. And, you know, we've seen, you know, with the BSE, for instance, there was millions of livestock culled because of this model this gentleman has been behind, some of the most damning worst case scenario models of all time. He's got a whole career history of that. Yet this is the man that we placed our faith in when he produced this model of, you know, the projection that 500,000 people would die if we don't do anything. But the problem with that is that even if that is in the small print labeled as a worst case scenario and not a prediction, well, it suddenly took the guise of a prediction in the media. And all of a sudden, when you put that on the newspaper headline, boom, if we don't do anything, 500,000 people are going to die. All of a sudden, it's not surprising that you get people literally signing petitions saying, please lock us in our homes. And that actually happened. Hundreds of thousands of people wrote to the government, said, please lock us down.
Crazy. But
that's the psychology of fear in action. No one is.
And the part, sorry to interrupt, but yeah, you just mentioned the media, this huge part, the mass media has played in all of this.
Yes, yes. It's an amplification that, you know, they have been an amplification device. You know, they've never had it so easy. You know, the headlines every single day, this many cases, this many deaths, this many infections, this many hospitalizations, dramatic image here, dramatic image there. They didn't even have to use real footage or imagery from the actual pandemic. I mean, there's been so many people that have identified, well, actually, that photo was from the 2017 flu pandemic. You know, they haven't even used real footage in the news reporting necessarily. You know, these overcrowded hospital beds. There's been countless examples of where those overcrowded. I'm not saying that they weren't overcrowded hospitals, by the way, but I'm just saying in terms of media integrity, using footage that isn't even relating to the current pandemic. There was one piece of footage that was used in three different countries to represent hospitals. You know, Italy, Australia. And it's just unbelievable. But so all of these things have led to a place where the public's perception, and you and I know from studying personal development deeply, is how our beliefs are formed. You know, if you see something on repeat with emotional intensity, it develops a belief. And then if you really want, you know, and if you hear that over a year, of course, your beliefs are going to be informed by the media. But then when you take an action that corresponds with those beliefs, i.e., washing your hands or wearing a mask or staying at home, you're then complying with that belief and reinforcing, driving the grooves that it's the right thing to do. It becomes identity level. So it's no wonder why then we can't start to critique and challenge the policy, because people have got, they're getting gut level beliefs that become very, very strong very quickly with that level of reinforcement.
Look, you know, and I might be a bit out there to say this, but I mean, it's propaganda. You know, you look at what happened back in the Second World War with the Nazis. I mean, Hitler managed to persuade a whole nation.
Yeah.
You know, okay, I'm going. I'm not at any point saying that people aren't dying of COVID. And please, I hope anyone that's watching this,
of course,
who has known people, this isn't the case. But it's no. Just it's believing everything you see, Dan, like you say, and without questioning, to some extent, is this actually the reality?
Yes. They refer to the science, right? And when you call something the science, you give it a badge. You put it in a space where you are saying this is the science that we follow. You're not saying we are having open scientific discussion. And the newspaper and the media coverage of the pandemic has been an extreme example of where we have not witnessed scientific debate. And for many of the public, therefore, they're not even aware that there is a scientific debate, because it's been censored, it's been smeared, it's been woefully absent. And, you know, even last night, you know, I put a post about this last night, because on the BBC Panorama, you know, there has been a lot of pushback from the scientific community, but it's almost in private quarters and in small fractions, which then inevitably go through a period of smearing because it doesn't suit the narrative. But there is a lot of scientific debate around this. But to the point, last night on the BBC Panorama, we've been talking on the podcast about some of the real problems with the testing protocols. And the testing itself is what drives the number of infections in terms of its measuring the infections, that is. It's used for measuring and quantifying the number of people who are hospitalized. It's used for quantifying mortality. So if there's a fundamental problem with the testing process itself, it becomes like a Jenga piece in the puzzle that if you pull that out, the whole tower can collapse down. We've been talking about many different flaws of the testing process. But of course, there's this big pushback and rejection. But now, you know, 7:30 last night on the BBC, Panorama come out and say, oh, these tests can be contaminated. There's going to be a chance of false positives here, which is only one aspect of the problem. And everyone suddenly goes, oh, hang on. Maybe there's a problem with the testing. It's like, well, yeah, we've been talking about that for a long time, but that discussion has been suppressed. It's been censored. It's been removed from public discourse. So none of these key issues, and that's just one small area, but it is a fundamental one because it underpins everything. But it's a really important point that we ask the question, why has this critique? Why hasn't this investigative process? Why is no one saying, even from March, why aren't we taking autopsies or postmortems of these deceased in order to establish the genuine cause of death, but not only the cause of death, to actually understand in those patients who truly sadly do die of COVID-19, what are the clinical factors and commonalities that we can learn how to then treat those? Because we can see that there's inflammation in the lungs, for instance. Therefore, well, perhaps we need to look at not only antivirals, but anti-inflammatories. But you only learn that from looking at postmortems. Yet it was codified in the Public Health England guidance from March that it was practically illegal to do a post-mortem, which was done on the basis of, we won't have the time. But you have to make the time for those important pieces. And we've already seen now from Italy, I think it was Italy, there was a cross-section of 67 autopsies that were done, which were all categorized as COVID-19 deaths. Only two of them, following that those series of post-mortems, were actual COVID deaths. Mm-hmm. So two out of 67 had clinical signs that their cause of death was related to COVID-19, yet the other 65 were not.
Do you think the government's trying to cover up?
Well, it's a big question. Are they trying to cover things up? We have to also then understand the political dynamics, right? So this is a very big question, because people are saying, though, there's this agenda, it's all being pushed, it's like a cabal, they're all driving this forward. There definitely are agendas that are occurring, you know. Oh, yes. we don't need to go into conspiracy to see what they are, because they're above.
No, and I think that's all been linked with it, and it's why people are just sort of saying, oh, yeah, it's another conspiracy theory. And I'm sure, Dan, you might have been tagged with the same brush as many people that have spoken out, or you're just a conspiracist. You know, my mum said it to me the other day.
That's when you take it back to the propaganda level, because again, if you look at tyrannical governments in history, they will use smearing tactics, and they will use all of these different things to prevent any real critique of the government policy. Now, that there is certainly evidence of that, but we also have a situation here where the politics and pandemics certainly don't mix, and this has been very evident. Because if you think about it, the prime minister or the leader of the party or the leader of the nation, they have to maintain the popular vote in order to remain in power. So if you're in a situation where you have a crisis and you've taken the decision to have a lockdown, you cannot really go much stronger. Once you take the extreme policy, where do you go from there? So there is this political dynamic that they need to be seen to taking action against this external threat. Otherwise, their citizens will start to say, you're not doing enough. So they're in this catch-22 situation whereby if they don't do something, their citizens will protest. But if they do something, you know, it'll either not be enough or will be too much. So it's this very difficult political balance. But unfortunately, making political decisions in terms of managing a pandemic does not necessarily correspond with the actual priorities in terms of risk management. And good risk management principles will not just look at the incumbent threat, i.e. the virus, it will look at the overall impact of any policy decision from a cost-benefit analysis perspective across every factor of human life. But we've not seen that. We've only seen a very myopic assessment of the situation.
Well, let's look at that. We're coming out of lockdown now. Slowly, restrictions are being lifted. But what is the impact, not just while we've been in lockdown, we've all suffered, but the long-term effects? I mean, I talk to a lot of people on my show about mental health. We've talked about suicide rates that have increased. People are not getting out. The obesity is going up, not to mention how many people are turning to a glass of alcohol to drown their sorrows, alcoholism going up. But financial toll, businesses closing, and then you've got the whole future of our children that are literally going through this, seeing masks and having to wear masks. I mean, sorry, Dan, what are your views on this?
I mean, you're absolutely right. So, but here it comes back to some of the points we've already raised. You know, we've gone through an what we're dealing with is an ideology of lockdowns. Lockdowns have been made an ideology, but not only that, they've been moralized. And again, studies have shown that this has been moralized. So you create a moral argument that lockdowns are the right thing to do. It makes it very difficult to then dispute against that policy. And by doing so, we enter into a mindset that we must save lives. That's the tagline we've heard, you know, protect the NHS, save, stay at home, protect the NHS, save lives. It's a mantra, bang, 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 catchline, branding, marketing. It's messaging that's hit on repeat, so it becomes a mantra. So stay at home, protect the NHS, save lives. So that becomes our most important driver. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't try and protect lives or the NHS or save lives. We definitely need to do that. But when it becomes the only thing we focus on, we eliminate the focus on every other important area. So, but we also have a very immediate and short-term focus. Now, when there is a crisis, and I've done crisis management training before in my corporate career, you have to take immediate action to deal with the situation at hand. But you need to do it in a contextual way. You need to make a very balanced and quick assessment of the situation. You make a decision rapidly, but then you don't have to stick with that decision once you've assessed the situation. You can then reevaluate, but we haven't gone through that. But nonetheless, here we are making these short-term decisions and ignoring, and again, it's a political dynamic that the politicians, they're not making the 40-year play. They're not looking 10 years down the line because they won't be in power in 10 years. They won't be here to pick up the picture. They won't even be here in 4 years' time. We can tell that. I can tell you that now, to pick up the pieces. So they're making short-term decisions. They're not looking at what is the economic consequences. And then, you know, again, I have to caveat the economic discussion because people say, well, lives are more important than the economy. But you can't intrinsically separate them in that way. It's like saying your leg is more important than your arm. They're part of the same whole, and you need both. You need both. And they are intrinsically connected. I was in financial services during the 2009 recession. Yeah. Now, following the 2009 recession, we went through a period of extreme economic deprivation in areas. And the healthcare markets in times of significant economic deprivation are severe. We see a massive increase in serious disease, and we see an increase in mortality over the longer term. So we will see deaths as a result of the economic deprivation. We will see disease as a result of the economic deprivation. Not only that, we'll see we've got a mental health crisis that affects every facet of the population. We need to help people unlearn the fear. We have to help people recover from trauma, essentially.
Yeah. Yes.
And we have to find a way to make people feel comfortable around human beings again. But there's all of these other damages from, you know, business closures, livelihoods lost, the mental health and societal factors, but also the political dimensions. Because what we've seen through this period is we've seen an erosion of democracy. If you look at the there's an annual report on the democratic on democracy every single year, and the scale has it's the democracy has reached its lowest point since the report began to be published. You know, it's descended, but in its place we've seen authoritarian decision making. We've seen erosion of the checks and balances. We've seen a power grab at many governments. But we can look to history to recognize that many of these power grabs, people believe they're temporary, but history will tell us otherwise. You know, these things often become temporary measures, often become permanent. So many people say, oh, yeah, lockdown, it's nearly over. Why are you still worried about it, Dan? Well, we've had our human rights suppressed. We still have our human rights suppressed. Democracy is eroding, and we haven't had a balanced inquiry. We haven't had a, you know, we cannot just walk away from this saying it's okay to do what you've done. Yeah, in my view, that there have been crimes against humanity perpetrated throughout this period. Yes, it's a difficult situation. I understand that. But this has been going on for over 12 months, and many lessons have been learned, but they haven't been acted upon. And I do believe that it's going to take 3, 5, 10 years for us to look back and say, my goodness, what on earth were we doing? And I can already see it. The talking head TV, you know, the types on TV, the talking head discussions, you know, talking about how do we, you know, we were locking up healthy people, you know, all of these things that we know we've known for a long time are not the most effective way to manage this pandemic. But it will take until this is over for us to get to that point, sadly.
I mean, you say this and it's still being perpetuated with the question of vaccines, and we couldn't talk about COVID and lockdowns without mentioning the vaccines and how that is actually it's separating society again. I find myself at the moment I don't want to take the vaccine. I'm not saying no and never, but you know, having spoken to my family, they don't understand my decision. It's like, why wouldn't you? And it's like, well, it's a choice. I'm very fit. I'm healthy. I don't see a danger. As far as I know, there are no, there's nothing to say that this is going to stop me spreading anything for a start. It's just going to, you know, slow down any risk of me potentially being hospitalized, etc. So why shouldn't I have the choice of deciding whether to do this or not? But you can already see it's fragmenting society.
It's a big issue. You've got to be careful of the V word. You know, if you're talking about the V word on a live broadcast, you can get censored. We've seen live censorship, so be careful with that.
That's ridiculous.
Exactly.
I mean, the whole censorship thing is absolutely ridiculous. But look, this vaccine and this question of passports, I mean, people are saying now, and again, it's hearsay, it's what the media are saying, you won't be able to travel if you don't get your vaccine. Oh, we won't be able to go into pubs now if you don't have the vaccine. And what are your thoughts around that?
On both those elements, we're seeing the exact same social dynamics that we've talked about. So we've seen the moralization of vaccinations. We've seen an ideological campaign around it. We've seen it made a pro-social attempt approach. It's being labeled as the you're doing it for the greater good. You're doing it for your nation. Again, it's indoctrination in terms of that mindset. If you don't do it, you're selfish. Now, but none of that actually addresses the underlying problem that, firstly, the vaccines haven't been in the trials. This is factual, that the trials only tested for the endpoint of symptom reduction. So if we know that the endpoint of symptom reduction is achieved, it means there's a less likelihood of someone getting severe disease and hospitalization and death, which is a positive if that manifests in the way that it's intended to, in a safe way. However, there's no confirmation through any trial process that transmission is reduced. So in terms of whether person A or person B has it, it's irrelevant, because if person B chooses not to have it, person A can still transmit it anyway. And the difficult situation here is, in terms of transmission, is that because the viral load can still be high in someone who's vaccinated, but they're not demonstrating symptoms, they can actually be an asymptomatic carrier. And to make the distinction between someone who's naturally asymptomatic, i.e. they've got no symptoms due to natural exposure to the virus, that the chances are they'll have a low viral load, and it's very unlikely, according to much of the science, that someone with no symptoms would transmit the virus. But if you've had a vaccine and you're artificially asymptomatic, so to speak, because the vaccine is what's limited the symptoms, you could still have a high viral load. Therefore, you could become a vessel of transmission. So actually, this whole idea of being selfish is flawed. But we've also eliminated the idea that natural innate immunity is a thing. You know, we need to achieve herd immunity in some way, some form. But the World Health Organization changed the definition of herd immunity to exclusively be achieved by vaccination, which has never happened before in history, because innate immunity, the natural immune response, acquired immunity from exposure to a natural virus, will provide antibodies and T cell responses. So in the same way, but unlike a vaccine, which is only, it's like an app on your phone, it's only designed to do one thing, your natural immune system will respond to the different variations of the pathogen. So actually your natural immunity in the healthy and young and fit is more responsive to any changes in the virus, whereas the vaccine needs to be manufactured in order to so that's why we're talking about booster shots and this like endless list of vaccines that you'll need to have in order to stay safe. Whereas if your natural immune system is allowed to do its own thing, then you can naturally tackle it. Now, I understand that, you know, that there is an innate risk that comes with that. But again, our ability to perceive our own personal risk has been flawed by the perception that's been created through the media and the data that we've shared. So for someone in my age group, I'm mid-30s, I'm a very low risk category, very low risk category of the virus. Therefore, I would be quite comfortable, in the same way I'm quite comfortable that my immune system will deal with the flu or a cold or any other respiratory virus, I'm quite comfortable that my body will produce a natural response and I'll get immunity naturally. And so far, the studies are very promising that natural acquired immunity is long lasting, as it was for SARS-1. So firstly, on the vaccines, that's the key point. We should have informed choice on that basis. Informed choice is not just about these elements of how effective the vaccine is, but it's also about safety. And, you know, there's a whole raft of issues around safety, the lack of transparency around safety, which makes informed judgment and informed consent very difficult. But when you take both of those principles and you apply it to a vaccine passport, you're in the same position. What difference does, if you've been vaccinated or you haven't, you pose equal risk to society. So having access to a pub or any service through a COVID certification is futile. I've just submitted a report to the UK government looking at all the operational, the medical, clinical considerations around this. But here we are on the precipice of medical apartheid. There's no joke here. This is, Israel, the health minister for Israel said, if you're not getting vaccinated, you're getting left behind, meaning you won't have access to society. Yet we fought for decades to stop that happening from gender, you know, having separate facilities for men and women and tackling that divide. We've done the same with racial equality. We've seen, you know, in South Africa, you know, societies divided by the color of their skin. Yet here we are in 2021 about to divide society on a health condition, a health decision that should always remain private.
Absolutely. And what do you say to those people, you know, and look, this is very simple, but just playing devil's advocate. Well, didn't you have the polio vaccination or the tuberculosis vaccination? You know, that's sort of some of the arguments that I'm getting back. And it's like, well, yes, but it's completely different.
It's a different pathogen. It's a different virus. It has different impacts. But actually, we need to look at the idea that the vaccination's the only way to deal with medical situations. We live in a world of innovation. I'm an entrepreneur. My brain looks for what is the key issue, what is the problem, and what solutions are available to us. And again, in this particular instance, we've got a situation where we've got these therapeutics, antivirals, anti-inflammatory drugs, as well as vitamin D, vitamin C, and natural treatments, which are showing real promise. Yet how much time has been spent within the media or the government in the last 12 months talking about how to bolster your immune system naturally? How much airtime has been allocated to these treatments that could significantly reduce the risk of the disease and death? Yet we are prioritizing vaccination. So you have to ask the question, cui bono, which means who benefits? And without getting into a conspiracy theory here, there is clear evidence that private financial interests are having a significant impact on the decisions that are made here. And if you dispute that, you've been asleep for a long time, because the world has been driven by money for a very long time.
They don't want to keep us healthy, right? That they're actually, they want us, a sweeping statement, but to be healthy, we don't rely on anything. We don't rely on medicines, things to keep us going. By keeping ourselves healthy, fit, going for walks, going outside, taking vitamin D, which I've been doing for years, all of these things that are natural, they aren't money producing.
Well, yeah, if you wanted, rather than mandatory or coerced vaccinations, if you wanted a healthy population, you could mandate exercise, mandate healthy thing. You could make cigarettes and alcohol illegal. But even with those things, I think if we go down that track, we were talking about this on the podcast. You know, there's some people that say we should pursue a zero COVID strategy. We lock the borders. We lock everyone up until it's gone. But they ignore all of the consequences of doing that. We could eliminate domestic violence by putting CCTV in every room in your home. We could eliminate road traffic accidents by eliminating cars on the road. But we don't live in that way, because we have a free liberal society where human beings are given authorship of their own destiny, and they're able to make their own conscious decisions with the information that's available. But if we live in a society where the information is censored and the ability to actually access open scientific information, and we're presented with one-way ideology, it becomes very difficult to live in that world. So here we are in a situation willingly, almost openly tolerating a divisive measure in society that will create a two-tier society without looking at all of the underlying factors that underpin it. And it's deeply concerning that we're in this place, because I believe we're at a point in time where we will go one way or the other. And I'm advocating for conscious change personally, because I do believe if we help work with people and educate people about how to live healthily, vibrant lives, then we'll create healthy, vibrant people, and we'll start to tackle bacterial or viral infections and serious disease. But you're absolutely right. Why, you know, how much time in the last decade has been invested in the public sector around driving positive health outcomes?
Absolutely. Dan, do you think we're going to go back into lockdown next winter?
I think there's a significant risk of that happening. The viral patterns suggest that come mid-September, we'll start to see a rise in influenza-like illnesses. You know, so this is the category that most respiratory viruses normally fall under, including human coronaviruses, HCOVs, of which SARS-CoV-2 is one. So we naturally see a rise in respiratory viruses at this point in the year, rising into the winter. And there's a real chance that if we see this happen again, regardless of actual impact, and if the vaccines are safe and effective, as we've been told, we will still see infections, but we shouldn't see the hospitalizations and mortality that goes with it. But we've almost become trapped in the mindset of lockdowns and the ideology of lockdowns. So I think there is a real risk of that happening. unless there is a civil public response that challenges that ideology, because I do not believe we can continue in this way. We must now learn to live with the virus. And actually, you know, there's I know I can already hear people saying, what about all the variants? There's a growing scientific discussion around the variants, which is based upon a hypothesis that lockdowns and mass vaccinations are driving the variants and preventing its natural evolution. And if you just go into Common Sense Corner for a minute, just think about that. Its natural path of transmission has been interrupted. It has to evolve, therefore, to survive. The virus only lives by finding another host. So if you take away its ability to move between hosts, or you vaccinate aggressively and on a scale, then it's a valid hypothesis that this could be driving the variants. Yet here we are in this mindset that variants are another reason to stay locked down. Well, actually, I think the variants are another reason to actually open up society based upon that hypothesis.
Wow, that's really, really interesting. I love what you said and hadn't thought about that. I just thought this was, you know, the variants were just, another excuse for the government to use these tactics again and lock us down and persuade.
Well, they are in a way. They've
become to take the vaccine.
There's been thousands of variants since the beginning of the outbreak. We just didn't hear about any of them. There was a major shift in the variant. There was a major variant shift in the early stages of the pandemic last year. It wasn't spoken about in the media, but now it's a lever. It's an emotional lever. People talk about variants now, but they don't talk about what is the actual evidence of increased transmission. What is the actual evidence of increased risk? What is the actual evidence of increased mortality? And if you try and find that evidence through the government, it's very difficult to get any compelling, meaningful information. So you're absolutely right. We now know it's a lever that will cause people to go back into fear. And when people are in fear, it's easy to make them comply with whatever instruction that you give them.
Yeah, we're opening up. We're opening up our doors. We're opening up society. We're back at events. Pubs are going to be open. People are going to be going to the gyms. We're going to be hugging each other again. It's going to be back to normal. And then you can see where the narrative is going on that.
Yeah.
Because like you say, the statistics will show that people are more catching the COVID again. And before long, we're going to be brought into this lockdown situation.
It's a risk. There's a very real risk. Now, fortunately, there's a lot of work being done by organisations like my own, which are challenging these policy decisions. This summer with the G7 summit coming up in Cornwall, very important meeting where we're actually going to be demanding a global public inquiry into the situation. But beyond that, looking at ways that we can actually develop solutions to ensure that any future pandemic response is proportional and evidence-based and balances the risks of the virus itself with the overall needs of society and humanity as a whole. And that's a difficult balance, but I firmly believe there is a better way. We understand very clearly where the vulnerable members of society are. But we must now return to an adult society where adults are able to make informed choices for themselves. Because I was speaking to someone in their 80s this week. They don't want to be locked down. They would, by all intents and purposes, be considered in that high risk category. But they want to make that choice for themselves. Because what is life if you're only existing?
Well, I think you've just knocked the nail on the head, really. What is life? And that is all we've been doing for the past year. We've sort of put our life on still pause, and we're all ready to click that still pause button and go crazy again, because we haven't lived for the last year, or we've lived a very different existence. In terms of that, I think there are things that we can learn.
Absolutely.
From this slowing down, I would say. What are the sort of things, Dan, that I guess going back to you, how have you changed? Who is the Dan now? This Dan that I speak to now to the Dan I met over a year ago in February, how have you changed?
In many ways. This is, firstly, it's been the greatest personal growth experience of my lifetime. But beyond that, it's also been the greatest conscious evolution. You know, it's put me in a space where I'm evaluating my own consciousness. And by that, I mean, how do I interact with the world? How is my... how do I fit into the world, and what does my own mind and body and spirit, what role does that play in society? And throughout history, I've been working on myself, my history, my life. I've been working on myself to get to a point where I can, you know, create a life that gives me the things that I thought I wanted. But now, actually, and many of the lessons I'd learned prior to this point anyway have come to life, in the sense that if we change ourselves, we can change the world. And now my focus is on about how do we create humanity 5.0, which is what I call, you know, it's the next iteration from the fourth industrial revolution. How do we balance the needs of technological and economic advancement with societal and humanitarian and planetary evolution? Because we've lived in a world of mass consumerism. You know, everything's all of our thoughts are infiltrated by external advertising. We create these false needs and wants. We're divided from each other. You know, the fabric of society is eroding. So for me personally, my own personal fabric has changed to really deeply care about humanity in the world we live in. And I truly, in the last 12 months, have made the commitment that I'm going to spend the rest of my life trying to make the world a better place, and advocating for conscious leadership and looking at how we can use the principles of innovation in a sustainable ways to make the world a better place.
Wow, Dan, what does that mean for you? What is the future? Is this Dan the politician, Dan the mayor? Are you going to follow in Brian Rose's footsteps? I'm sure there are lots of people out there watching your pandemic podcast that would as well.
I was hijacked the other day and propositioned to stand for mayor in Bristol. I politely declined that one. I've always said I'd like to make my difference from outside. Right now we're building this idea of a global assembly, which will essentially be a forum for humanity, where we start to look at the key pillars of existence. You know, what does the future of education look like? What does the future of governance look like? What does the future of law look like? What does the future of sustainability look like? Creating these global discussions, and rather than in the way that the World Economic Forum have conducted these discussions, which is top down, you know, private companies, you know, deciding the trajectory of the world, looking at how do we create a truly democratic humanitarian approach, or humanistic approach to human evolution, and working together on how we can improve the world. So I am now working on different ways that we can reimagine and bringing together some of the finest minds with members of the public and society themselves to actually look at how do we create a better world. But beyond that, looking at how I can lean on my own past, which is how do we awaken our own potential? How do we evolve and elevate our own consciousness? Because I truly believe change starts at home. If you change the person in the mirror, you can change the world. And I think that happens one person at a time. And the more of us who become awakened to our own potential, and the more of us that can elevate our own consciousness, then together we really can create profound change in many, many different ways. So I'm focused on how do we create conscious change through humankind itself? Because at the root of every problem is a human. So if we can elevate humankind, then I think we can change the world.
Wow, I love that, Dan. I've got to thank you for speaking from your heart, for acting from a place of courageousness. And really battling those fears, because you've really stepped up. Your conviction and articulation of all of this has been absolutely top class and phenomenal. Look, I've come to my last question. I feel like I could talk to you and have discussions all day, and I'm dying to meet you in person. But my last question, although I think you've answered it, is if you were to write a message in a bottle, for future generations to find, what would that message be?
Well, that's a big question. How big's the bottle? I think I'd keep it right now. The first thing that comes to my mind is be yourself. Simply that. Be yourself. There's two words, be yourself. Because I truly, my own transformation right now and the ripple effect I'm able to create as a result of that is because I finally gave myself the permission to be myself authentically, untethered, free from the fear of external judgments, and truly centered into my core aligning with my core values and living and breathing version of who I always have been, but have not given my permission to be. So number one is be yourself. And if I got a big enough bottle, I'd write a whole story around my views on how you can do that.
Dan, thank you so much. It's been truly an honor to have you as a guest on my show. Thank you, Dan.
My pleasure. Great to be here with you.
Hope you enjoyed the show. Remember, there's a new interview out every Monday. So hit subscribe and like, and you'll get it straight into your inbox.